So the Dhamma for today is the Natha Karana Dhamma, the Dhammas for making a refuge, or protection, or support, Natha. The Buddha said, Ma bhikkhave anatta viharata. Don't you, O monks, live without a refuge, without a Natha, a protector, without protection, without support. Dukkho bhikkhave anatto viharati. One without refuge dwells in suffering, lives in suffering. The usage of the word refuge is common in the Buddha's teaching. Another word for it is sarana. So we go to the Buddha for refuge, the Dhamma for refuge, the Sangha for refuge. But the word natta means something to protect you against suffering, something to support you when through challenges, something as a refuge to protect you against danger and discomfort and suffering. It's considered, it's one way of understanding the Buddha's teaching and the goal of the Buddha's teaching, to provide this refuge, to answer the question of how to free ourselves, how to protect ourselves, provide safety from suffering. It's something that interests people in the world. People with no interest in spirituality are still very much invested in trying to acquire and maintain and build, cultivate refuge, finding refuge in people, cultivating friendships, relationships, supporting family members and finding support through family members and so on. Places as refuge, people fleeing danger from one place to another, securing residence, buying a big house or a mansion or something to protect you from the elements, but also to protect you from theft and crime and violence. We find refuge in money. So many external refuges that we use as a means to protect ourselves from suffering. Of course, from a spiritual perspective, these sorts of refuges are not guaranteed and are not sufficient to truly free us from suffering, and moreover, they're not dependable. People are not dependable, they change, or at best they are temporary support. When they get old, sick, or die, that sort of thing. Places as well can be taken from us, can be destroyed, can be damaged, can be violated, can be penetrated. Our secure location, secure residence is not always as secure as it seems. Even money, of course, can come and go, can disappear in a flash. Worldly refuge is unreliable, not something we can depend upon. So the Buddha had a list of 10 sorts of refuge that are truly a refuge, truly a support, truly something that can protect us from suffering. Spiritual refuges. The first of these is sila. As we've seen again and again, sila, ethics, morality, our behavior is the very base of our spiritual practice. And as a refuge, it's the most basic sort of refuge. The coarsest and most obvious form of protecting yourself from suffering is to be a good person, to avoid cultivating bad karma, avoid cultivating animosity, enmity, avoid becoming culpable for the suffering of others. First of all, this protects us from revenge, it protects us from punishment, but more deeply it protects us from the chaos of the mind that comes from lack of ethics, lack of a mental cohesion, mental consistency, where we act in a way that is in line with our wishes. So we wish ourselves to be free from suffering, and so we don't bring suffering to others. We're careful to avoid those actions that would harm others: killing, stealing, cheating, lying, taking drugs and alcohol. These things are a refuge internally and externally. Externally, a person who kills and steals and so on is not someone who is reliable, not someone that others will respect or care for or consider worthy of their support and protection. And internally, killing and stealing and so on corrupts the mind, pollutes the mind, it warps the mind. It destroys focus, it destroys all the beneficial qualities of mind that we try to develop in the Buddha's teaching. So our activities of speech and of body are the very basis and the first step in cultivating a true refuge, a true freedom from suffering. So as a practice, sila is the basic practice. As a refuge, it is the most basic form of refuge that we have from a spiritual perspective. The second is bahusaccha. Bahusaccha means much learning or much knowledge or having heard much. Knowledge of the Buddha's teaching, knowledge of the truth, knowledge of good teachings in general is of course a great refuge spiritually and just in general a great support, a great means of protecting ourselves from danger. When danger comes, the capacity, the knowledge of how to deal with adversity, how to deal with danger, how to deal with challenge is a basic step in overcoming and bearing with and seeing ourselves, our way through any challenge or difficulty. In the practice of the Buddha's teaching, it's the first step to cultivating, to actually practicing and developing the qualities of enjoined by the Buddha. You have to know what they are first, and you have to know how to develop them. You have to know how to do walking meditation and sitting meditation. You have to know the theory behind the practice of ethics and the practice of meditation, and you have to know the theory behind wisdom. What are we aiming for? What does wisdom mean in the Buddha's teaching? What did the Buddha teach about suffering and the cause of suffering and so on? All these things are very basic knowledge. If you have learned these things and learned them to some great depth, it's a real support for the times when you don't have a teacher to advise you and support you and guide you on your practice. Throughout our lives, our knowledge of the Buddha's teaching is something we can fall back on. When difficulty comes, we can remind ourselves of the Buddha's teaching, of the teachings and the practices and the guidance that we have learned and been given. So study and listening to the Buddha's teaching is a valuable refuge. It's something that we carry with us, even outside of the times when we're with the teacher in an intensive practice situation. Now, great knowledge is a double-edged sword, of course, for a person who doesn't practice. For a person who just studies, just learns it, it can be useless and in some cases can actually be to their detriment. A person who has learned a lot but practiced very little will find that when they do practice, they have great doubt. Their preconceived ideas about things which are based on intellectual study can often hinder their progress and make them doubt their teachers and their training and so on. So it's important that, while this is certainly a refuge for those who practice, it's important to not rely on knowledge. This is a refuge that is ideally suited for those who are engaging regularly in intensive and methodical practice of the Buddha's teaching. But a refuge nonetheless, something of great importance that the Buddha did encourage and acknowledge as a great refuge for those who are able to use it, wield it correctly. The third is kalyanamitata, beautiful friendship. Now, as I said, people are obviously a great source of refuge, even in a worldly sense. Everyone relies on their relatives, their partners. Children rely on their parents rely on their children, friends, and so on. spouses, they rely on each other. This reliance is a staple aspect of society and an integral part reason for society's functioning, for why society or how society functions in order to support each other. But people in and of themselves are only a support, obviously, if they are good friends, if the relationship is a beneficial one. And moreover, our capacity to cultivate friendship and to navigate relationships in harmony is of course essential to actually making the relationships a valuable commodity or valuable support, a refuge, true refuge. If even though we are in contact with good people, if we don't have this capacity of friendliness, to be friendly, to be kind, to be thoughtful, to have good relations with these people, then the relationships are meaningless, are unbeneficial in both directions. So good friendship has two aspects to it. First, that we choose our relationships, that our friends and our associates are those people who are beautiful, who have good qualities. Obviously, some friends are going to lead us in the bad direction. There are those friends who will encourage us to commit unethical acts, who will drag us down and drain our energy and that sort of thing. Those who will manipulate us for their own gain, those who are full of empty promises but never deliver on them, those who praise our bad qualities equally with our good qualities, and so on. Friends who are with us only for the benefit they can get from us. Just because they're our friend doesn't mean it's going to be a refuge for us or for them. And the other aspect, of course, is our own quality, our own ability to navigate the friendship. That even though our friends may be beautiful and wonderful and good people, if we don't have good qualities and the capacity to support them and be kind and thoughtful towards them, and then it's of no benefit to us. Then they certainly won't have any interest in supporting or caring or relating to us. So good friendship, the Buddha said, this is the very essence of the holy life, of the spiritual life, having good friends and having a good relationship with our friends, being a good friend ourselves, something that allows us to rely on others. In sickness, though, they can protect us against other people's manipulations, providing us with good advice or protecting our good name when others speak badly or lie about us or malign us or that sort of thing. They can protect us and provide support when we're sick, when we're injured, when we are destitute, and so on. Good friends are essential. And of course, it goes both ways. We can be a good friend to others and be a refuge to them. Most importantly, the best sort of friend is the one who has good guidance and good advice, who reminds you when you falter, when you make mistakes, helping to correct you, helping to prevent you, giving you advice and encouragement on the path, one who is not necessarily a teacher, but a support and a kin on the path, a brother, a sister, a partner in the practice of the Buddha's teaching, someone who supports you, who doesn't drag you down. This is a refuge, something that the Buddha encouraged. It's something that we see in a meditation center, how we encourage each other, how we have a teacher who encourages us, and also how our fellow meditators appreciate and give us space and provide a harmonious atmosphere. Having good friends like this, having a good environment like this that is supportive and encouraging, where we provide an example for each other and support on our practice, is an essential part, much more valuable than even living alone. Of course, if you're unable to find good people who are also practicing, then living on your own is preferable, but it's no match for living in a community where others are able to provide this sort of support, or these many kinds of support. So good friendship is a refuge. The fourth is sovacchasata. It means being easy to talk to. So this relates most especially to relationship with one's teacher, but it's a quality of an individual, the capacity to receive instruction without argument, without doubt, without overanalyzing, criticizing, without talking back, without being distracted from the teaching. Sometimes one might not be upset or have any sort of animosity towards the teacher, but they may not listen. They may not take the practice to heart. That's something that we can recognize and see as a danger. Being easy to talk to means accepting teaching, accepting criticism. It also doesn't just relate to a teacher. It can relate to our fellows in the holy life. Sometimes in monasteries, someone might criticize, a monk might criticize another monk, and then the monk being criticized gets angry and insults the monk back. And this is a common occurrence because of the lack of being easy to talk to, easy to admonish. This is a refuge for us. Being easy to admonish is a refuge, obviously, because it allows us to be criticized, allows us to improve ourselves based on the criticism, based on the advice that others give us. So our ability to receive the teachings given by a teacher or the advice and criticism given by our fellows is an important refuge, especially for those who are dedicated to practice of the Buddhist teaching. It's important that we receive the teachings with an open mind, with a willingness to try and put into practice the teachings and give them a chance before we reject them, not just rejecting them outright or being suspicious or so on without basis. And of course, being interested and being attentive to the teachings. Being easy to talk to also means paying attention, remembering, keeping in mind, and taking seriously any sort of advice or criticism. And this goes both ways, this goes always as well. I mean, even senior monks can be criticized by junior monks or lay people. Sometimes lay people will criticize monks or so. It doesn't just mean only taking advice, it means being able to listen. Even if someone is totally immoral and corrupt but sees something wrong with you, you should still accept at face value any criticism that you gain. This capacity, this quality is an admirable one. The ability to see things clearly and to accept criticism for what it is, not being blind to or being just accepting any criticism blindly, but to be objective about any sort of advice or criticism, take it at face value and put it into practice as best you can and as best you see fit. Being easy to talk to, this is a refuge. It's a refuge on our path to realize the Buddha's teaching. The fifth is kinkarniyesu dakata. Kinkarniyesu tasa dakohoti, or dakata. So kinkarniyesu means whatever activities. So it means whatever activities your fellows in the holy life are engaging in, having a interest or a skill or a capacity to help them. It's a little bit difficult to translate. I'm trying to translate somewhat literally. What it means is help, the ability and the skill and the interest, the thoughtfulness in helping others, your fellows, helping your fellow monastics, your fellow meditators, when you see that they need help. This is a refuge in this sort of setting because we aren't parents looking after our children, or children being looked after by our parents. We all come together here of our own free will, with no promise to take care of others unilaterally. This is something that goes both ways, and all of our relationships here should be harmonious and symbiotic, where we help each other. We have to look and we have to see when others need support or need help. There's so many relationships that we have: the teacher's relationship to the student's relationship to the teacher, monks' relationships to each other, and lay people and monks' relationships with each other. These sorts of relationships are essential for the well running of a monastery, and more, even more, a meditation center, which has added complexity because of the courses that we run. So we have to have this sense of thoughtfulness for each other and for the monastery as a whole, seeing the things that are left undone by others and helping them to complete their tasks, seeing when others have burdens and helping to lighten their burdens, caring for each other and being thoughtful. The word dukkha is an interesting one. It doesn't mean just being ready to help. It means being skilled and actually putting some thought into helping others. The idea is that we are ready to help them and not just perhaps giving lip service, paying lip service to the idea of helping, saying, well, if you need anything, let me know. The idea is to be take initiative and to put some thought into the needs of others in the monastery. This is a support, this is a refuge. I mean, this sort of thing is what essentially creates harmony and thoughtful thinking of each other kindly. It leads our fellows to think of us and to appreciate us. It's a refuge because then in our time of need, we can certainly not be surprised when others come to our aid as they remember the good things that we've done and appreciate our kindness and wish to return it. So it's a refuge. It's a refuge in terms of how it leads people to think of us well. It's a refuge in terms of how it leads to mutual support. And it's a refuge in terms of the goodness that it gives us, this confidence in ourselves of being a good person in terms of helping others and being kind and thoughtful towards the needs of those around us. The sixth is Dhamma Ramata, Dhamma Kamata, love of the Dhamma. Or desire for the Dhamma. Kama is an interesting word. It usually is desire, usually means desire or lust or that sort of thing. But when it's related to Dhamma, Dhamma means truth or the Buddha's teaching, the Dharma, the teaching, the code, the doctrine of the Buddha. This means the appreciation and the interest and the desire to put into practice the Buddha's teaching, the love of the Dhamma. This is a quality that is an essential factor for those looking to benefit and develop and come to maturation in the Buddha's teaching. Because it's quite common for the arising of discontent, boredom, aversion. A person can be averse towards meditation, can be averse towards the Buddha's teaching, often spurred on by desire for sensuality. When we think of sensual pleasures, it makes meditation practice and the more peaceful activities of the Buddha's teaching seem dull, uninspired, unexciting, as we lust after the more immediate pleasures and the immediate enticement of sensuality. So the cultivation and the possession of love of the Buddhist teaching, love of the Dhamma, love of the practice, the keenness, the keen interest in hearing the Buddha's teaching, the keen interest in practicing and realizing the Buddha's teaching is a true refuge, something that we have to identify in ourselves and cultivate and care for like a precious treasure. And we of course guard against boredom, guard against irritation, guard against frustration, guard against any kind of aversion that comes up. And it commonly does come up irrationally, even though we might know and be sure that meditation is a great thing, valuable thing, we still unbidden give rise to these sorts of negative qualities of disliking of the practice of the Buddha's teaching. And so we're taught not to ignore these things or try to push through them, but to face them and to expel them through the direct application of mindfulness. not by fighting with them, just by facing and patiently staring them down until they disappear. And through this we change our attitude towards experiences. Rather than desiring certain types of experiences, we're able to see experiences just as they are, and we're able to appreciate things just as they are, and see the truth for what it is, and appreciate this truth, and have a familiarity or affinity, sorry, towards the truth, towards the Dhamma. This is Dhammakama. Dhammakamo bhavang hoti. One who loves the Dhamma, who has interest and affinity towards the Dhamma, is someone who is bhava, it means high-minded, or a developed person. Number seven is vidya. Vidya is an integral part of the Buddha's teaching. It means effort or energy. So being energetic is an essential quality of progress, obviously. You can't practice intensive meditation without cultivating energy, and the cultivation of energy allows you to practice more intensively, to progress and to cultivate all sorts of beneficial qualities. The Buddha said, viriyena dukkham ajjeti. We overcome suffering through effort, not through being lazy. So we normally think of effort as something that allows you to progress, not so much as a refuge, something you can you fall back on. But the thing about effort and energy, it does have to become an integral part of our character. It's not something we can exert temporarily or cultivate temporarily and then expect to be free from. It's something that has to become a part of our character, a part of our personality. Because the cultivation of the allowance of laziness, allowing ourselves to become complacent and lazy, doesn't just prevent us from progressing. It allows for all of our unwholesome and unskillful qualities, our negative and harmful qualities, to grow. It's like a stagnation that allows all of the impurities in our mind to grow and to mature and to expand and to consume our minds. Effort is something that is a quality of mind that is integral to an enlightened being, that they are never without a certain amount of natural energy. They are energetic by nature. This is a refuge, something that we shouldn't think of as a temporary quality. It's something that we should cultivate as a part of our personality, to be energetic. It's something that protects us against ourselves and helps to destroy and keep at bay any unwholesome habits that might crop up or might take root in our minds. Number seven is santuti. Oh, where are we at? Six, seven, number
Just
eight.
Seven.
Number eight is santuti. Santuti means contentment. Contentment, we've talked about this before, but contentment seems a very sort of simple idea, something that we might dismiss as being a very basic sort of practice. Yes, we have to be content, not complain. But contentment is really the essence of what it means to be enlightened. A true contentment only comes through the attainment of freedom from suffering and the freedom from defilements. Contentment, true contentment, means not having any complaints whatsoever, not voicing complaints, but having nothing to complain about, not wanting for anything that you don't have, and not wishing for things to go away that you do have, wishing for change, wishing for things to be different in any way. Contentment doesn't rely upon an object, doesn't mean you're content with this or with that. That's sort of a basic form of contentment where you say, well, this is good enough or that is good enough. Contentment should be ideally independent of any sort of object. Contentment means not requiring anything to bring you peace and bring you happiness, to have your happiness and peace not be dependent on any external or internal quality or entity whatsoever. Contentment means having no possibility for disturbance, for distress, for stress or suffering. Contentment is the truest refuge. It's a quality of, again, the enlightened being, and it's a true refuge because it makes one completely safe. When you don't rely on anything, you don't rely on external factors, people, places, things, sights and sounds and smells and tastes and feelings and thoughts, and when you don't rely on states of mind, you don't rely on thoughts, and you don't rely on emotions, you don't rely on experiences to satisfy you, then obviously there's nothing that could possibly harm or threaten you with harm. There's nothing that can make you lose your equilibrium. This is sort of an explanation or description of the goal that we aim for in the Buddha's teaching, to be completely independent. The Buddha said, anisito jiviharati, to dwell independent. So contentment is an essential quality that we're trying to cultivate in the practice of mindfulness. As we note things, we're changing our attitude towards them, straightening the mind out so that seeing is just seeing. Every time we say to ourselves seeing, we're reminding ourselves that's all it is. This one isn't good and this one bad, or that one nice and that one nasty. Sights and sounds and smells and tastes and feelings and thoughts, everything. It just is what it is, and is only what it is and nothing more. And when we see like that, this fosters true contentment. It allows us to experience this pure and perfect contentment that is a great part of the Buddha's teaching on enlightenment and an essential part of what it means to find a refuge in the Buddha's teaching. Number nine, of course, this would never be complete without sati. Number nine is mindfulness, or sati, meaning something like remembrance, but referring specifically to the practice similar of the sort that we practice here. This sort of practice is the cultivation of sati, or mindfulness, remembrance. And it's again just this simple facing the experiences and seeing them as they are, saying to yourself, seeing, or hearing, or pain. This sort of reminding yourself leads to remembrance. And what is meant by remembrance means to remember things just as they are, to not lose sight of seeing is seeing, to not get caught up in ideas of what we think it is, and not lose sight of the essential nature of experiences. Sati is the greatest practical refuge. Of all of these refuges, this is the one that is the most powerful in terms of something that we can put into practice. It is ultimately the highest form of practice because it is ever-present. There is no situation where you are conscious that you cannot theoretically at least put mindfulness into practice. And practically speaking, it's something that we can and do apply in all instances. Even when we don't have, when we aren't facing adversity or danger or challenge, we put it into practice. We cultivate it day in and day out. But when difficulty arises, when we face challenges or stress or suffering, mindfulness is the truest refuge that there is. We can apply it in any situation. For physical pain, we face the pain. Having trained, having practiced, it is a true refuge. Because when the time comes that we have to face true and severe pain, we face it with mindfulness, we face it with wisdom. We're able to see it clearly as it is without getting upset or suffering from it whatsoever. When we're faced with fearsome danger and threats and so on, mindfulness is going to be the greatest protection, no matter what situation we find ourselves in, poverty, sickness, any sort of loss. Mindfulness is the truest refuge that protects the mind and frees the mind from the stress and suffering caused by clinging, caused by reaction, caused by attachment and caused by getting upset by our experiences. Not much needs to be said there. We know how to practice it, and this should be very familiar and very ring very true for all Buddhist meditators who undertake the practice of mindfulness, as they're very quickly able to see the benefits. And finally, number 10 is panya, wisdom. Now I said sati is probably the most powerful practical refuge. It's not the highest refuge. The highest refuge is wisdom. But wisdom isn't something that you can directly put into practice. Wisdom is the highest refuge because it means seeing through the causes of suffering, seeing through behaviors, actions, seeing through attitudes that might trigger suffering. When you have wisdom, it quite literally means not relating to reality in ways that would cause suffering. I mean, that's the very definition. So freedom from suffering means having the wisdom to not cause suffering. I mean, the core theory is that suffering doesn't come from our experiences, it comes from our attitudes towards them. It comes from our interaction, our perception, how we take them. You can't suffer unless you get upset about something. Suffering can't just be physical. It can't just be something external causing you harm. The harm has to be your reaction to the experience. And wisdom, by its very definition from a Buddhist perspective, is that which prevents that, prevents the reaction, prevents the stress, prevents the judgments that would trigger suffering, would trigger pain and sadness and sorrow, lamentation, despair. Wisdom is the ability to see clearly and to know and to understand the right and the wrong way and the difference between different reactions, different perspectives on experiences, to know that anger is a cause for suffering, greed is a cause for suffering, delusion, to be free from the delusion that might cause us to react with greed or anger, that would trigger us to be stressed or upset by any sort of experience. Wisdom is the only true and ultimate and lasting refuge, something that is unshakable. As long as wisdom is present, there is no possibility for any sort of stress or distress, despair. Wisdom is so deeply founded in the psyche. It's something that is so pure and so powerful that it completely frees us, because it is so very basic, it frees us from any sort of suffering whatsoever. And wisdom is the result of mindfulness. The point of it is that when you practice mindfulness, it allows you to see clearly. This is the word vipassana. As you practice mindfulness, just by facing and not judging your experiences, just by having a very simple and ordinary relationship with them, objective relationship without any judgments, then there arises understanding. Our perspective towards experiences is as they are. This is seeing, this is hearing. And our disliking disappears, our liking disappears, and so our wanting and our aversion also disappears. As a result, our stress and disappointment and suffering all disappear and have no foothold, have no potential for arising in the mind. Sati and Panya are often joined together in the Buddha's teaching as a pair for this reason, because the Sati, its most important quality is that it leads to wisdom. Sati is most beneficial in terms of how it leads to seeing things clearly as they are, to change our perspective from judging, oh, this is good, this is bad, I like this, I don't like this, to this is seeing, this is hearing, to see through that, and more importantly, to see the problems with clinging, to see that our attachment to things, either liking or disliking, is really only causing us stress and suffering. And when we see clearly in that way, we abandon craving, we abandon aversion, we abandon any sort of desire for things to stay this way or change or any which way. And so we gain contentment, we gain all of these many refuges just naturally through the cultivation of mindfulness and the acquisition of wisdom. So these are the 10 Nata Karana Dhamma, another very valuable way of looking at the Buddha's teaching, something that we should take to heart. Obviously there's many here, something that we can go over again, something that it's good to go back and look upon, as it might be hard to remember these, and this is the kind of Dhamma that we can go over again and again, reminding ourselves and reflecting on how we're putting these or not putting these into practice, and to use them as a means of correcting our practice, as a means of making sure that we're cultivating the Buddha's teaching to its fullest. So that's the Dhamma for today.